Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. My guest tonight is Rene Perez, and hopefully we'll be talking to him in just a minute. Should be dialing. There we go. Hopefully.
This is Rene.
Hi, Rene. This is Mac.
Hi, Mac.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you fine. So we should be on
Excellent.
The air then. So how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm okay. Thank you. So we might as well just jump right in, actually.
Sure.
Now, I know that you were writing and drawing comic books as a young child. So tell us about that, how you came about to write and draw your own comic books.
Oh, you know, I just did that for fun. Playing with my action figures sprouted out towards, wanting to write things down. And that led to drawing comic books, and I could always draw, so it was a pretty easy thing. And oddly enough, the few comic books I've had published as an adult, I didn't even draw them. So I guess it was just all wasted practice. But all kids who are into nerdy stuff, if they have the ability, I think they would all draw or write comic books. You know, it's a very fun thing to do. It's like an extension of playing.
Mhm. Yeah, I know myself. I may have been okay with the writing part, but I was a terrible artist, so I would have had to have somebody else do that part.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it all boils down to what you practice. Artistic people sometimes can kind of do it all, but it depends on what you practice. For example, I draw so slow now. I think I could draw better when I was 14 than I do now, and I could do it a lot faster because I had a lot more time to sit and just, you know, practice that. So no matter what artistry you do or whatever talent you were born with, you do have to practice it and get the technique and put in the hard work. So I just haven't done that on the drawing side of things, and I can understand why you would have wanted an artist too to go along with your writing, because, you know, it's always best to go with whoever's the premier expert in that one field.
Yeah, I did try. I mean, I tried and tried. It wasn't that I didn't try. I kept trying and kept trying, and I never got any better. And I'm like, no.
Oh. Well,
yeah,
but you're a writer, you say?
Well, I do some writing here and there, and I've had things published, so I can consider myself sort of a writer, but, you know, not like a published writer as far as novels, just mainly stories and little things that I've had published,
yeah,
and mainly
well,
in local papers.
Yeah, well, that's a writer, all right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, something else that I know, that in your teens, you became a musician, or maybe that's when you considered yourself a musician. So tell us about how that got started, and then how that led to The Darkest Machines.
Oh, you know, I just, again, our artsy-fartsy kids have these inclinations towards artistic things, and you know, I could play the piano and play a few other instruments. And when I was a teenager, I started playing in a band and started playing in clubs. And I never even finished high school because of all of my music work, which wasn't conducive to waking up in the morning to go out and go to school. And I also played with older people, because I was the only musician that I ever met who wasn't a drinker or a drug user. So the older bands used to hire me, not because I was any good, but because I was a designated driver. So when I was 15 years old, I was playing with, you know, 30-year-old musicians because they knew I was such a nerd that I wouldn't get drunk and crash the van on the way home after the gig. So, yeah, I started playing in vans, and that was a great life. And there's really nothing better for a musician than playing live music. Even movies doesn't bring as much joy as playing music live. But, yeah, you know, music is not something that you can really, unless you're playing shows constantly, it's nothing you can monetize anymore ever since the internet came along. Movies are going down the same road, unfortunately. But music has been gone for a long time. If people always ask me, why is there no new good artists? Why there's no new Led Zeppelin? Why there's no new Mozart for that reason? Well, there could be. There could be music geniuses out there, but in the United States, we only elevate people with good marketing skills. So if you're a bad musician, but you're great at marketing and you have 10 million fans, a publisher will come and want to publish you and give you a record contract so that they can have access to your 10 million fans. And that's the way it's been for the longest time. So it makes a generation of music that doesn't not made by people who are there by merit, but made by people who are there because of their marketing skills.
Right.
So you're never going to find another Mozart like that. So yeah, it's a kind of a bummer of a field to be in, because it doesn't matter how good you may be, and the best musicians of all time may be somewhere playing right now with no marketing abilities. Usually artistic people don't have talents outside of artistry. So if all their talent lies in music composition, they most likely don't have any talent for marketing and advertisement. So it's a little bit of a sad truth, but you know, we could still hang on to the bands and the great musicians of the past, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I have a really good friend who's been my friend for, maybe almost 40 years. And he has a one-man band, and he still plays, although the pandemic has caused him to lose a lot of his business because he wasn't allowed to go out. But now he's been allowed to go back out on a limited basis and play.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so talented. And he's still making money at it, probably not as much as he did years ago, but he's one of the few, because
yeah.
I know it's hard, like you said.
Yeah, if you could still play live shows and dedicate yourself to that, that's the only place. I mean, even if you're the biggest rock band in the world, you don't make any money off of the CDs or digital downloads anymore. You have to play. So like Metallica wouldn't be making any money from their album. They get money only from their tours. So musicians who play live are the only ones clinging on to any last hope for music. So I applaud him.
Right.
Thank him on my behalf.
Oh, I will. I tell him all the time how great he is. He really is, because he's one of those people that can just pick up an instrument and start playing it. And he's got the ones that he can play better, and he's got the ones that he prefers. But he can basically just play anything. And he sings, so it's not like he just has a band. He also sings. And he's got a good voice. Yeah. He reminds me of a Beatles type with the scratchy type voice. Kind of voice that he has. But it works good when he does the rock and roll songs.
And everybody loves rock music. I know I do.
Yeah. And he also does country and stuff too. And, you know, Jimmy Buffett, and that's the kind of stuff that he likes doing. But, yeah, and he's got a good following. So, you know, good for him.
Yeah. I hope we can cling to it through this whole situation here that's happening. But what can we do? We're all under the fire of that. Luckily, I've been able to continue filming But my whole first half of the year, I didn't really film a commercial movie because no producer wanted me to go out and film because they were worried about lawsuits and, you know, whatever. So I just filmed a short film for fun, you know, on my own just to keep my chops up. And finally, halfway through the year, I got back to work at my regular day job and I did a Western. And now I'm doing a vampire movie. So thankfully, I've been able to get back to work because I don't know how to, you know, get free money from the government or whatever it is they're trying to get everyone addicted to. So I would have just, me and my family would have just become homeless and kicked out for not being able to pay our mortgage. But yeah, I'm back to work. I'm glad your friend is back to work. I'm hoping for the best for all of us. But yeah. I'm afraid that until there's some kind of massive disobedience, that the powers in charge will continue this until we're all in debt to banks, until every older or sick person who collects insurance or disability is dead. And the only businesses that remain are Amazon and Walmart. So that's what I'm worried about. I mentioned that, you know, that movie, The Insurrection, that is my notoriously infamous blacklisted movie. I made that in 2019, and I did mention these things. I did mention that we are being social engineered and that a virus is what they would use. So everyone asked me, why did that movie get blacklisted? It looks just like all your other movies, and plus it looks even better. And it's certainly my best reviewed movie, but it's because I kind of was a whistleblower on these things. Not that I have any insight, not that I have any, I'm not part of the elite or anything like that, but I do have the perspective of not having had television or anything for since 1993, which gives a huge clarity of thought. And you know, I've always known that all of my friends, it's kind of like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I've always known that they are either indoctrinated to the left or the right. And I've always accepted it. But now, unfortunately, there's a huge takeover of the entire human population. And all this ambivalence I've always had is now costing me because I'm going to get taken down with them. So that's why I made that movie, The Insurrection, to try to tell people, hey, you guys, both sides are our enemies, and they only work towards, you know, making us, having us under their thumb completely. So, but it's blacklisted, you know, so it's not getting the type of audience that all my other movies get seen in the millions. You know, when I have a slasher movie, I even go to where they're pirating them, and they've been pirated in the millions. So everyone sees those, but my insurrection movies being very well, the villains are winning, basically. So
hopefully, eventually, the message will get out, because it reminds me of 1984, you know, the book 1984.
Yes, yeah.
Because in that, yeah, people forget about what that's really about, that the government is, there's only three governments, and then two of them are always fighting, but they switch off on which of the other three they're fighting with. And so when they're fighting with one, they say that they've always been fighting with that one, and they were never fighting with the other one. And then everybody else just believes it because the government said it, so they believe it. Instead of remembering, well, hey, no, we were just fighting with them. Oh, no, we weren't. and that's basically what's going on.
Right, and everyone seems to be focusing on the presidents and who's going to be president. And I'm like, well, who cares? Obviously, they're both working for the people who want to control our breathing and vaccinate us and microchip us and catalog us and have us dependent on the government. What does it matter? I live in a rural area and everyone is very conservative, and I think I'm a conservative person too, but not when it comes to politics. And everyone thought that Trump was their savior, but I said, you know, he's only there to pacify you, to make you think you have a friend. But in the end, he'll inject us, he'll make us wear masks to control our breathing. He'll do everything that the bad guys will do, that the liberals will do, but he'll just do it with a little bit of sugar to make you feel like he's on your side. And I just can't believe in 2020 that people still believe in these things, but what are you going to do? Again, it's a situation of people who are there not by merit. Trump has never been a hero. He's never shown any leadership. Biden is the complete antithesis. He's been in there for almost longer than I've been alive. He's never achieved anything. And talk about a loser, you know? So it's like no one's there by merit. They've never, you know, won a war. They've never even been to battle. They've never even taken IQ or leadership testing, which we require of our officers who want to be lieutenants, you know, in the military. So talk about just a screwed up system. So it's just like music, and the same way movies is going down the same road too. It's the same way politics are. So it's very strange. No one's there by merit. Not anymore, at least, you know. But I'm sure it's like that everywhere. I'm sure if you went to McDonald's, the best worker is not the one who becomes manager because he's busy, you know, doing a good job while someone else is sneaking their way up to the top through manipulation in the same way that politicians do it, sadly. So, and here I am in the middle. Yeah. Here I am in the middle saying, hey, shouldn't we, for something as important as the president, make them take tests or something? I mean, it's like, anyway, who am I? I'm just a B-movie maker. So.
Excuse me, I needed to clear my throat, sorry. I'm going to go ahead and jump to your first credit on IMDb, whether or not it's your actual first movie, War Machine. Tell us about that one.
War Machine. I'm trying to remember which that was. Well, if it's if IMDb is correct, which I don't know where they would get all my information from, but I made a couple of ninja movies, like kung fu movies. And there were sequels. There's Ninja Warpath and War Machine. That's what they were. And they were just for an Asian distributor, and you know, they wanted to try it out on me, and it worked. I guess they made money, so they asked me to do a sequel. But you know, it's back in the days where there was mini DV tapes, like in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing anyone should look up. Let's just leave it at that. The cameras were really bad back then. I would prefer you didn't, audience. Skip forward
okay,
a few years.
Yeah, I'll only skip forward a year because there's one where you obviously were happy with the film because you made two other ones. Because in 2011 you did The Dead and the Damned, and then in 14 you did The Dead and the Damned in the Darkness, and then in 2018 you did The Dead and the Damned 3, Ravaged. So tell us about those three movies.
Well, those were my first movies that I filmed in America. The first two that you mentioned were in the Dominican Republic. So this is my first, you know, movie that was filmed in America for, I guess it was the first time that Western and zombie movie had ever been brought together. And I didn't realize that until we got halfway through filming. And we got offers from distributors before I was even done making the movie. And they were all congratulating me on how did I think of such a thing? And I thought, oh, has there never been one? So I learned the hard, I assumed that there was dozens of cowboy zombie movies. But at the time, I guess there hadn't been. So that just became a financial success. And, you know, once the receipts come in is when they tell me to do a sequel. A lot of people
right.
think I get to choose what I make, but it's not actually the case. If something is an easy sell and makes money, they do ask me to make a sequel. But I'm never the one that gets to choose. I was very happy with the sequel of that movie. And the third one, I think, is pretty good, too. But it's been a while since I've seen him. But, yeah, I have been thinking about making a fourth Den of the Damned once I – if anyone ever starts talking to me about zombie movies again, I will remind them that I have this little franchise and I would love to continue it.
Now, in most of your films, you assume multiple roles, you know, director, writer, cinematographer, editor, composer. So do you have a favorite thing to do, or do you enjoy doing all of those, or is it because you kind of have to do it, or a combination?
Oh, it's because I have to, yeah. I don't like, for example, I really don't like doing the production. Any production work I hate doing, but I have to do it because there's no one else. I'm basically a one-man show. It's just me and my actors.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a producer will come along just to make sure his money is being spent correctly or whatever the case may be. But, you know, money men are horrible at holding microphones and lights, and they do a horrible job. recently, I do have a good producer who comes along and helps me along with items here and there. But sadly, it's usually, most of the time through all of my years, has been just me and the actors. So that's a bummer. But I do love my job, and I do love that I can do this for a living. And, you know, I like B-movies. Already I was a fan of them, so it's not completely out of my wheelhouse. And I don't have to be in Los Angeles. I could live in a beautiful place out in the country and, you know, pay my bills. And it's hard work, to be sure, but so are other jobs I've had in the past. And this one's artistic and creative and makes me a very happy person who longs for nothing else in the world. So hard though it may be, I'm happy to do it.
Oh, well, good. And when you can do more than one thing, that actually is good, because then you're not dependent on so many people. And if you're like in indie filmmaking, it helps you save a little bit of money if you can do more than one thing.
Absolutely.
Oh,
I mean, if...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I was just saying, I hear your doggy.
Yeah, our little yapper. Well, it is imperative because basically I get such cheap budgets, you know. And once my fee comes out of it, my paycheck, there's very little to make a movie with. So I'm sure that's why everyone comes to me, because I could do the things. I could do a music score, you know, because I'm a musician. I could do the camera work because, you know, like I said, artistic people can usually do a little bit of everything. And if they focus themselves, they can be really good at it. So I've become a very good cameraman, very good music composer for movies instead of songs, and at least commercial grade, you know. So it does make life cheaper for the people who hire me, and they give me a lot of gray hairs and a lot of extra pounds on my end with the stress of doing it all. That's a trade-off.
I'm sure.
A lot of sleepless nights. Yes. And you know, I have to make one every 4 months, so it's people always ask me, Renee, how could I do what you do? And I'm like, I don't know if you would want to do what I do. What I do is very difficult. There's no sleep involved, and, you know, it's just a very, very difficult when you're working at the bottom of the barrel, but you have to make movies that compete with the $1 million range budgets but you're only given like 50,000. So that's the world that I live in. I get these $50,000 budgets three times a year. I'm told to make, you know, whatever they're like, hey, we need zombies, make a zombie, or we need a slasher, make a slasher, or we need a kung fu movie, make one of those, or we need a Western, you know. So I just think of what I have. I write around what I have. I'm like, hey, they want a zombie movie, I'll make a zombie movie. And, you know, I write the best one I can. And 4 months, I have to turn in a completed project. So it's not as easy as people think. You know, I'm more like a plumber or house contractor, you know, and someone says, hey, Renee, make me $1 million house. Here's $50,000. Go do buy the materials. So that's in a nutshell, that's my job. Very not glamorous.
Now, this next one, I picked it because you acted in it, and that's one of the things that you don't do a lot of. Obsidian Hearts in 2012. So tell us about that one.
Did I act in that one? I must have been someone
who
just
what IMDb
had
does.
A line or two. Yeah. Well, you know, in that movie, I had a cameraman, a very good cameraman. So I wasn't able to – I didn't have to do the camera as I do on all the others. So I might have snuck on if an actor didn't show up or something. I might have – I think I played a commando or something now that I'm recalling. That was so many movies ago. I think I only had one line or something. And I just, you know, took the place of someone who couldn't do it or didn't show up or something. It was nothing nothing major. But, yeah, that's how I came to act in that one.
Hmm. Well, and I know that you're not somebody, at least from the way you're talking, you're not somebody that really wants to do a lot of acting anyway. But what I've always said to the people who do have those aspirations, hey, everybody's got to start somewhere when they have these really small roles. And then I remind them that there are so many movies where the small roles are the ones that are remembered.
It does happen. Yeah, it does happen. I don't know if – I'm sure that there are some directors who mainly want to be actors – and they think that this is their way to get it. But I can't imagine anyone who truly loves being a storyteller caring that much about being an actor. It's usually people who start off with aspirations of acting. And there have been some great ones along the way. But in this B-movie world, I think it's, at least as far as I've seen, the directors want to be directors and actors want to be actors. And it's good because when you're on the set, you're my attention has to go so many different ways at all times. I don't think I could put myself to remember, you know, big pages worth of dialogue on top of everything that I have to do on the set. But if anyone could do it, more power to them. They might be supermen or superwomen.
Yeah. Well, let me see. So then in 2015, this is another where I'm lumping three of them together. There was another series of movies you did. 2015 was Playing with Dolls, 2016 Playing with Dolls Bloodlust, and 2017 Playing with Dolls Havoc. So tell us about the Playing with Dolls series.
Oh, that's my most popular thing. There's actually four of them. There's a movie called Cry Havoc. But I asked I asked the distributors to drop the name Playing with Dolls because the first two Playing with Dolls movies were only released, if you've seen it, and most people, when they know me, that's what movies they know me from, are Playing with Dolls. But the thing is, the first two were released heavily censored. I'm not sure why anyone would censor a slasher movie. I mean, they're always, you know, showing nudity and blood and guts and violence, and mine were no different. But they were so heavily censored that I want nothing to do with them. I told the distributors that they can go to hell, I'll never work with them again, and all that kind of stuff. Of course, they don't care because they're the money men with the fancy cars. But
yeah.
It's just, I don't want to have anything to do with it because so I made the next movie to be called Havoc, but they still wanted the name Playing with Dolls Havoc. So instead of just like Friday the 13th used to be called Friday the 13th, but then it later started getting known by his name Jason. I figure these are close enough, you know, these Playing with Dolls Havoc movies I make are like 80s slasher movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gone through weeding out the name Playing with Dolls, and I recommend no one watch the first two, only watch the second two, because those, I demanded to have them not censored, you know, had a part of my contract. And the fourth one just came out. It's called Cry Havoc. Came out this year. And I haven't seen the release, but I did check that it was the same length. So it looks like they haven't. I went to Best Buy and, I got a DVD of it, but I haven't watched it to make sure it wasn't censored, but I don't think it was because it's the exact same running time as my master file. So,
okay, good.
Yeah. But those are my most popular things, and they're just slasher movies. But you know, I make them as good as I can. I take them as seriously as possible. A lot of people, when they make retro movies, they make it like a joke. It's not a joke to me, because to me that's the golden era, the 80s. And 70s are the golden era for me for cinema. And, of course, probably nostalgia has a lot to do with that. But because I'm born in the 1975, and, you know, I was 4 years old when 1980 rolled around, and I was able to see all these great works of art, or so I consider them. So I am a person who does retro-style movies, but I don't do them as a joke. I do them pretty straightforward. And because of that, these Havoc movies have become very well liked. I mean, geez, I even got someone sent me a picture of his tattoo of Havoc.
Oh, cool.
So people are getting tattoos of this, and I'm so happy that people like it and appreciate the hard work that the actors and I put in. So, yeah, that's by far the most popular thing that I've made.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to say about Cry Havoc? Because we've got plenty of time if you want to talk about it some more.
Sure. Are you editing this, or are you going to leave this all in?
Right now it's live, and I just
leave
everything
in. Oh, it's live.
Anyway.
Well, let me be a little bit more charming then.
It also gets recorded for people to listen to later. So,
nice.
And I don't cut anything out because that's silly.
Well, there's no need to. I was just didn't want to burden your audience with things that don't matter. But now that I know, I will focus my efforts that way. As far as Cry Havoc, I don't think it's censored. It is the first time that I put my my other popular thing is that I've made movies with an actor who looks just like Charles Bronson. And
I saw him.
Yeah, when I say he looks just like Charles Bronson, I'm not talking about a lookalike. I'm talking about what is can only be explained as a perfect clone.
Mm-hmm.
I would never make a movie with a lookalike, but like they used to make those Bruce Lee movies in the 70s after he had died. Charles Bronson died, you know, 17 years ago, and this guy is just a perfect recreation of him. Like Mother Nature said, no, there needs to be another Charles Bronson or God or whoever's in charge of these things. And they made this guy. So I found him and I made a few movies with him. And one of them was Cry Havoc. So in this movie, there's a policeman character. And I thought it would be fun to mix my worlds, my B-movie worlds a little bit, and add in someone from my other movies. And so he plays a policeman in this Cry Havoc. So for anyone who's, I guess, old enough to remember who Charles Bronson is, they'll probably have to think twice and start looking up the credits and wonder what the heck is going on. I've had people think that it's him. And I was like, well, you know, if this guy was making movies in the 50s and it's 2020, it, you know, it seems very unlikely. I think he'd be 100 years old now. He certainly wouldn't look like my actor looks, which my
right.
actor looks like Bronson in the 70s and 80s. So, which is, you know, over 40 years ago now. So that is always a double take moment for people who are unfamiliar with my stuff, whether they're watching Cry Havoc, which just came out, or the most popular movie I did with the Charles Bronson guy. I don't mean to jump forward too far on your IMDb search, but I'm sure it's on there because it was very popular. I did a movie called Death Kiss. So like Death Wish, but Death
right.
Kiss. And that was also a wonderful movie that I'm very happy with. And I had just finished making a Western with that Charles Bronson guy. And a producer called me, and we were talking about the next movie. And he said, well, so what are you thinking next? And I said, well, I have this Charles Bronson lookalike guy that I just made a Western for another producer. Why don't you take a look at him and see if you'll allow me to do it? And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I would love to do a Death Wish kind of movie, you know. And we joked around, and the name Death Kiss, you know, came out jokingly. And I didn't know that they were really going to call it that. Or else I would have been worried about making the movie so close to Death Wish. But it's basically like Death Wish, you know, 3. If the one that they made hadn't come out, they could have put mine in its place. Or Death Wish 2, even. The first Death Wish movie is a real actual piece of cinema, which at a B movie I couldn't try to compete with. But Death Wish 2 and 3 are very B movies. And even though they're much higher budget B movies than mine, because of technology and everything, I was able to make one that competes, you know? So I always tell people, well, if you don't like the Death Wish sequels, you can just watch part one and then watch mine as a part two or a part three, you know? So that's another strange situation that ties into Cry Havoc. Most of the people who watch the Havoc movies are on the young side. The emails and the tattoo picture and all that stuff come from young people who they might not even realize who this mustache-looking guy is. But for the older people, they will certainly have to start Googling how on earth is Charles Bronson still alive, looking so good, and in this silly B movie. So,
well, before I actually looked through the stuff, when I first saw the one picture, just the picture of the the poster part, and it had him on there, I just thought it was something like what they do in movies, where it was something that was taken from an old Charles Bronson movie. That's what I thought until I looked at it for a few more seconds, because it's just like that first few seconds, and then after those first few seconds, you realize, well, no, that's not him.
Well, you got to watch the trailer and the movie and all that kind of stuff for it to all start to make sense in your brain. But, yeah, we've had some very comical reactions. Also,
yeah,
when we're
sure.
filming, you know, you go out to film, and you got an early morning, so you go out early, and that's when all the seniors come out to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So you're having breakfast, and you have all these senior citizens looking at me and Charles Bronson talking about what we got to film today, and they're, you know, all doing double takes because they're all old enough to remember who on earth, and they're like, how is this possible? So it's a very strange occurrence. Like, I've never seen a thing like an absolute clone of someone being made. So it's, I don't know, it's just weird that I'm the only one who's taken advantage of it. I thought that he would get picked up by more prosperous filmmakers, you know, like Quentin Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez, people who also like the retro aesthetic, but who are more well-funded, you know, people who also have
right.
a talent for doing business, which they do. And I thought that they would snag him up. And I thought, oh, I'll make a couple of movies with him, and then he'll be off to the big leagues, I'm sure. But no one has snagged him up. I mean, there are some I don't know, some copycat, you know, filmmakers and producers who have tried to hire him and make their little movies, but it's been years and none of those movies have ever come out. And, you know, they just see me having success with it, but they're also bottom of the barrel people. So I don't know how well those will turn out. But I really thought he would shoot up to the big leagues quickly, especially with as popular as that Death Kiss movie was. I mean, as far as B-movies, it was about as popular as B-movies get. It's a niche audience.
Well, in 2017, you did a film that you also produced, which is something that you don't do a lot of, From Hell to the Wild West. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a movie that I wrote. It's an old idea I had for so long about Jack the Ripper continuing his murder spree in a place where he is not being hounded by a sophisticated police force like Scotland Yard. All the people that were after him in Whitechapel, London, were very sophisticated. They were even doing forensic science for the first time in crime investigation. So I thought it would be interesting if he ever went somewhere where people died all the time, from Indian attack, bear attack, shooting each other in the street. You know, people in the Wild West just would disappear, and you would not suspect serial killer. You would suspect something else. So I've always wanted to make a movie on that topic, and someone who wanted to, a producer said, hey, can you do something like The Dead and the Damned where you make it horror, but also a Western? I said, sure, I've got this idea, and that's how it happened, and that's how I actually was able to get the Charles Bronson lookalike ever to be in a movie, because I was like, oh, I'll make him a guy who's, you know, going, he's the law, he'll be going after Jack the Ripper. So again, just a very fantastical high concept that would be better made by a huge budget, you know. But sometimes B-movies are great at that. You know, B-movies are great at taking concepts that people think, oh, that's a great idea. And then you just try to make it as best you can, which is what I did. But as far as producing it, I don't know. That must be a mistake, because I never I do the production work. Like I produce the whole movie, but I'm not the investor in any of the movies. So if that's what it was stating, IMDb, you are wrong. I didn't even realize I had IMDb until just recently. So I don't know how you correct things or who you would call. But anyways, IMDb is not the greatest institution. It's also like, this is why I don't make A-list movies, because I tell the truth about everything. But IMDb is basically a way for them to monetize on people by turning them into numbers. So basically, the higher your number, the more a producer wants to hire you. So if you follow all the Amazon guidelines for IMDb and you raise yourself through the ranks, whether you're a good actor or no, you have more viability for a producer to hire you. So it's just another way of people who are not chosen by merit to be chosen through a made-up metric. So IMDb is a pretty horrible instrument, and it leads to movies being made based on how many of their actors have high numbers. So when I talk to a distributor, they tell me, well, who's in it? What's their following? And I said, well, no, I don't know. You'll have to talk to see if they have a publicist. But I hired them based on their acting ability. It's what movies should be made on. I don't know what their number is or how many fans or any of that. So, you know, I'm still a foolish guy out there not trying to climb the ladder of success in Hollywood. That's why I avoid going there like the plague. I am a person who is sincerely, foolishly trying to make these things as good as I can for the enjoyment of the audience, which for me means hiring people that complete the image, you know, of the movie and who are good at their craft. So it's a very stale and fake world, and unfortunately it's creeping into everything, including movies now, are specifically being chosen. Everyone tells me, Renee, you're Hispanic, you should try to play that side up, and you were poor and you've been homeless and you've been all these things. You should use your story to propel your career. The victim narrative that people like to always project, and I always decline. I decline anything where I'm chosen because of my ethnicity, because everything in the world should be merit-based. And movies have got to turn around and stop hiring people who are good at climbing the ladder of success and going to parties and networking, and start hiring the weirdo who's good at writing or good at directing or good at being a cameraman. The way it is now in Hollywood makes no, they don't even try to hide it anymore. As of 2015, 2016, the edicts have been out that you have to follow the political side. And if they tell you to wear a mask, you've got to wear a mask on your Facebook. And if they tell you to, who to vote for, you've got to vote for that person. And if you say, oh, well, this class of people is a victim, you've got to say that. Well, I'm no one's victim. The world has never been fairer. In fact, the fairest world that humans have ever achieved. And I don't think that anyone needs to give me or any other ethnic or any other group any extra anything. It should be by merit. It should be blindfolded and said, hey, do you like this movie? It doesn't matter who made it. Just do you like it, yes or no? And that's what I stick by, and I don't play any of the games. So, in fact, that's why I try to fight against those things. And that's why that movie, The Insurrection, explains all of these things. Because I'm sure that all of this intrigue happens in everything, in politics, in the pharmaceutical industry, in the agricultural industry. I'm sure that there are stories and there could be whistleblowers everywhere. I happen to be in this business, so I know the distributors have to say what the producers have to say. I am a very small fish. I'm not Steven Spielberg or even Robert Rodriguez. I'm like a cheaper Mexican version of that guy. But I still am an expert. I've still made dozens of movies. I still have a peek inside the curtain. And since I have no aspirations for a Hollywood takeover and a huge career and all these things, I'm the only one willing to say, peek behind the curtain and expose these things. So most of the times that I have been asked to do movies that are propaganda movies, I will say no, and in fact, I will do the reverse and make something that is the opposite side of that propaganda. So anyway, I don't know how we got into that tangent, but I hope that was the answer to your question.
I just was listening.
Oh, because of IMDb is what led us down that rabbit hole, yeah. They are a huge contributor to the blasé-ness of the world of what used to be cinema, you know.
Well, in 2018, you did Alien Showdown, The Day the Old West Stood Still. I like the title. So, and you were a fight choreographer in that as well. So tell us about that one.
Well, that's actually a very old movie. The year is certainly wrong. But, you know, the thing is sometimes they re-release movies.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have just gotten the newest release on that. But that's a Western, again, you know, off a distributor called me and said if I had anything else like that zombie Western, but different. And I said, well, I can do an alien Western, you know, like an alien pod lands on Earth in the Wild West, and it's a scout looking for water. And once he realizes that there's edible animals called humans and plant life and water, he will climb to the highest peak and signal for his people to come here. And the only one who could stop him is a cowboy, a wanted outlaw who wants to do something good. And so that's what the movie's about. It's a silly B-movie plot again. But, you know, it's a fun type of plot, you know, a six-shooter versus an alien cannon. It's like Predator, I guess, in the Wild West, except for the Predator's not hunting anyone. He's just trying to alert his people that this planet has water. So, yeah, and the fight choreographer, you know, I used to be a martial arts coach. And whenever I am the best martial artist on the movie, I usually do the choreography. But I have done newer movies where there are far better martial artists, and I let them take over. I'm sure you're getting close to those movies now because of the year on the IMDb thing. But yeah, the Alien Showdown or whatever that movie's called, that's, I think 2010 movie or something like that. Very old. Hmm. One of my first handful of movies. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that happens a lot, and sometimes the people even realize that because it took them so long for it to bring it out. Like, I've got a friend that he had made this film in 2009, and it just mm-hmm. recently came out. So it's like almost mm-hmm. 20 years old, but yet it's got a recent date on it because it was just released. So, I understand
how
that works.
This one has been released about three times, sadly. I don't know what it is about it, but it has been released under different names and different artwork. And they usually don't even tell me about it. Like one time I was just at Walmart with my wife and I saw this movie and I was like, wait a minute, that's like a copy of mine. And I lifted it up and I looked in the back and the artwork on the front was so different. It revealed nothing to be like my movie. But then I looked in the back and it was my actors and my movie. So, distributors are also slimy entities. Sorry, any of my distributors who are listening, but you guys know I don't like you anyways. There's no secrets being broken here. But they are unscrupulous, very unscrupulous people. But, that one has been released more than it deserves. Let's just put it that way. No need to go look up that movie, audience. It's a... unless the premise piques your interest, it's just a silly grindhouse type of movie.
Okay. Well, we're getting close to the end of the time, and let's see, about 7 minutes. So if you can talk about Cabal like in less than 7 minutes, you can go ahead and talk about
that. Sure. Cabal, I think, was also released this year. And, since everyone likes my 80s aesthetic, I made that one super 80s. And basically like an old print of a movie that was filmed in the 80s that was just recently found. So that was me going full retro. And hoping that people liked it. I mean, I don't know. It's got four out of five stars on Amazon, and I guess that means people liked it. I don't know if that means I should continue making movies with that type of aesthetic, but it's basically like an old action movie mixed with an old John Carpenter-style horror movie. So, it's worth checking out if you are in that niche audience of people who likes those type of things.
Okay. Now, since we're down to like 5 minutes, is there anything else that you want to talk about that you feel like you didn't have enough time to go over? Because now would be the time at the last 5 minutes.
Sure. Well, I just did a movie with Michael Paré called Righteous Blood. The trailer is up on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com and then /IDIC, IDIC. Or it's also up on my website, which is thedarkestmachines.com. And yes, there's an S at the end of machines, plural. and I'm also doing a movie right now that I'm very happy with called The Vampire and the Vigilante, which was going to be a comic book, but once I made the first book, a producer wanted to make it into a movie. So I'm the only one who has a copy of the first book because a licensing deal had to be struck. Very happy with that, how this movie's turning out. And we'll probably put out a press release pretty soon, or you can go to my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thedarkestmachines. And you could see what that vampire movie is looking like so far. And then I have a couple of new movies that came out this year, Cry Havoc, I think, being the best out of the bunch. And then The Insurrection is clearly the best one out of all of them. And that one, like I said, it's very hard to find. But if you go to Amazon, you should be able to see it there until they choose to take it down. And it's also on Vimeo. So it's on 4K on Vimeo. And that movie, if you are interested to know from a whistleblower's point of view into all of the craziness that goes into trying to social engineer people through movies and TV shows, it's certainly a showstopper, something that you'll definitely won't believe the things that are being said, but it'll all make sense once you hear it. All the pieces kind of come together, and it's probably the most important movie I've ever made. And I hope everyone would at least give it a try, no matter what your politics are. This is not about politics. This is about all of us humans. Stop looking at each other as the villains and look at the elite criminals who have, you know, who can afford to treat us like cattle. If the people only knew everything that goes into the Hollywood machine, everything is being funded now only on its ability to social engineer. So if you're doing a Star Wars movie or a James Bond or a whatever, it's got to promote a victimhood narrative, which is made to make people weak. And if people only knew the reality of it. So if you go watch The Insurrection, the trailer had some dialogue that would have explained it all, but it had to get edited out because it kept getting deplatformed and taken down. And so we finally, after months and months, were able to get Amazon to concede. So they said that they wouldn't promote it. They wouldn't put it on any of their lists, but they would allow us to have it up for as long as it didn't cause any trouble if people had a direct link to it. So if you can watch The Insurrection before it gets taken down, I suggest you do so. If that is of interest to you, if you're a person who just thinks you're not influenced by movies or television and you don't watch or whatever the case may be, then it won't be of interest to you. But if you are a person like most of us who watches movies and everything, I just watch Blu-rays now. I don't even watch, I haven't had television for decades now, but luckily, you know, there was VHS back in the day, then there was DVD, now there's Blu-ray. So I can watch old movies, some of which that have good propaganda, and I just watch those now.
Okay, we're down to like the last minute. So is there anything else that you want to say in closing?
No, I would just thank you for doing this interview with me, and I think I've said everything of interest. I'm not that interesting of a person. I think that was all everything interesting about me was said.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, and I wish you much success in the future. And I'm going to close out the show now and say goodbye and good night.
Goodbye and good night to you, too. Thank you so much.
Okay, and thank you as well. Bye.
Bye.